From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the outdoors, where a woman found, as she describes it, a sense of purpose and freedom. Yana Keshber is a licensed clinical social worker who worked with New York City firefighters impacted by the 9/11 tragedy and other disasters. And the work took a toll on her, led her to struggles with her own addiction. Years later, when she entered recovery, she felt overwhelmed by emotional pain. And it was then that she began biking, weightlifting, kayaking. She found that being physically active, especially in nature, strengthened her both physically and mentally. She wanted to help others find and stay on a path to recovery. And together with Sean Smith, she co-founded Rockcovery Fitness. The nonprofit provides a safe, fitness-oriented community for people recovering from different kinds of addiction. And as you will hear this hour, it has made a difference in the lives of many people in Monroe County and beyond, especially in recent years as the opioid crisis has grown. According to data from the Monroe County Heroin Task Force, the number of deaths from opioid overdoses in Monroe County dropped to the lowest point in April since tracking began. But since then, there has been another spike in the number of fatal overdoses. Rockcovery is rising to meet that challenge by expanding its programs and its staff. And we're talking about the organization's growth this hour, as well as the impact on the community. We're going to hear recovery stories from multiple members of Rockcovery. We're going to hear about how a local therapist describes a change in over 10 years of work in the profession. It has been a difficult journey for many people, and we're grateful that some of our guests are willing to share their own stories this hour, and it starts with Yana. So thank you for being back here. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And remind us when Rockcovery Fitness was founded, Yana.
It was founded September 2015 was when it became an entity, a nonprofit. We started working in January of 2015.
All right, very good. Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here. Also with us is Emily Balsh, who is a member of Rockcovery Fitness and Living in Recovery. Emily, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also with us is Monica Starr, a member of Rockcovery Fitness, Living in Recovery. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Sarah Ormsby is a therapist and a social worker in practice for more than a decade now, and it's nice to have you as well. Thank you for being here, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yana, you know, I mentioned at the outset here that there was this moment earlier this summer and in the spring when there was this hope that we were seeing the numbers of overdose deaths declining for the first, I mean, still at a high level, but the first decline in the numbers in a number of years. And it appears that we've had another spike since then. I mean, there's so many different people, everything from law enforcement to social work to just people and families working on this. But is there any encouragement that you see? How do you generally feel about, let's start with opioid, then we'll kind of broaden out to addiction. How do you feel about what you're seeing?
I think we've been mentioning kind of all along, or I've heard it all along, that, you know, this isn't quite yet a time to celebrate. Absolutely, the decrease in overdose death is incredible. However, we're still losing people at an incredibly high rate. And there are a lot of factors. You know, we've now have a collaborative effort between law enforcement, treatment, recovery, a multitude of great organizations. There's a ton of services, but we still need to be vigilant and look to continue to fight the epidemic and not necessarily, you know, celebrate and praise all the accomplishments.
Yeah, and Sarah, we'll talk as we go throughout the hour about what you've seen. But generally speaking, do you agree with what you just heard from Yana about the importance of kind of trying to stay on top of this and not getting too far ahead of looking at one set of numbers or another yet?
I do, because it's you know, inevitably an ongoing battle. And so even though, like she was saying, there have been improvements, there's still a ways to go, unfortunately.
Yeah, and the numbers are staggering. I mean, we're talking about dozens of people overdosing every year in this community. And so before we kind of get into some of these personal stories, I think really illustrate the challenge and also some of the hope. I want to remind you, there's an event coming up on Sunday, September 15th. It's at Mendon Ponds Park. It's the 5K and X Challenge, the 2019 5K and X Challenge. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, Yana?
Yes, it's an incredible event. It's our fifth year doing this fundraiser. It's our only annual fundraiser, and it's grown in just 5 years from 140 people at our very first event to last year. We had over 500 runners, which was absolutely incredible. And it's a family-friendly run, walk. There's a trail component, a road component. There's this X Challenge that is always fun and exciting.
Tell us a little bit about the X Challenge. Like every mile, there's like you got to do like push-ups and stuff like that.
And air squats and burpees.
Oh, air squats and burpees.
Just burpees. Every mile.
Do you do that one, by the way?
We did. Last year, myself and Sean, we kind of sent all the folks off and then attempted it for ourselves. It was fun.
Fun is one word for it. So it's a 5K, and again, there's a trail course. It's really, really well run. And it's not just for people living in recovery. It's for the entire community, supporting the recovery community. So again, that is Sunday, September 15th. It's a beautiful Mendon Ponds Park. And you know, you can walk or run on the paved course or on the 5K trail course if you want, or if you want to do the mildly insane X challenge, whatever you want to do. But it's the registration's happening now, rockcoveryfitness.org.
Yes, correct.
And it's in the morning, and it's an awesome community. So that's a great opportunity to kind of get in and support the recovery community and also to have a great event. It's really, really well done. I'm going to start with Monica Starr, and I want you to tell us just a little bit about yourself and about, you know, you kind of your journey to recovery. Take us back through the beginning of what addiction and recovery mean for you.
All right. I found recovery fitness through my outpatient counselor, through Evelyn Brandon. She showed us a TED Talk about the Phoenix and talked about recovery fitness in Rochester here. And I looked it up online, found some outdoor workout classes to go to, and was hooked ever since.
Tell me about what led you to that point in the first place. And again, I will mention on air what I told Monica and Emily, and I've told Gianna in the past. You know, we're talking about some personal stuff, and they can draw any boundaries they want, but I think they're also really brave and courageous telling these stories of recovery. So take us back to kind of the beginning of what happened with you.
Sure. Forgive me, I don't have a lot of experience talking about this, so I'm just going to do
no
my
problem.
Best
no
here.
No problem at all.
Prior to recovery fitness, I was a professional ballet dancer. And when I retired from performing on the stage, I didn't really have a plan that had that type of focus and physical activity. So my addiction kind of increased at that point in my life and took over. And it made my life unmanageable. And I ended up not performing in my other jobs and lost my job. And you know, being unemployed, it took a big toll on my life.
What was an average day for you during addiction like?
I was attempting to maintain a high functioning, what we call high functioning addiction, where you can still go to work and you know you're still achieving your responsibilities, but eventually it does catch up with you. And so I would just try and keep it all together at work, and then you know, just go home, and the addiction kind of took over.
For people who have addiction to alcohol, sometimes they have told stories on this program and elsewhere about trying to be high functioning, maybe sneaking alcohol in a car during work break or things like that, but trying to sort of hide from coworkers, et cetera. For those who have been addicted to other substances, it's the same kind of thing, maybe before or after work. Did you think for a while that you were maintaining a balance enough to keep doing it?
I thought I was maintaining a healthy balance, but one thing that they say is, or not a healthy balance, but manageable.
Yeah, manageable. Sure. Yeah.
But they say, you know, I've heard the escalation is, you know, at first it's fun. You know, then it's fun with consequences, and then it's consequences. And my life eventually got to the point where it was just consequences, and I needed to find help.
Were you talking to others who were in similar positions? Were you essentially alone in your addiction?
I did not have a support, much of a support group. I did not have a lot of guidance until I found help through Unity in Rochester. And from there, I found out that there are a ton of resources in Rochester that we're fortunate enough to have.
But I think in my own experience and just listening to people tell their stories, there has to, at least from my observation, come a point where you decide you want that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So was there one day, one moment, one event that made you decide, yep, this is enough?
I think so, yeah. It got to a point where I knew that I needed help, and it was, I just kept putting, like, a time goal, like, after this holiday, I'll get help. After this event, I'll get help. And those events kept happening, and I hadn't taken that step yet. So there wasn't any big turning point. It was just, enough is enough. It's time. I can't go on living my life like this, and I need to do it for myself.
Did you have people telling you, get a hold of yourself or get help or anything like that? No?
No, not really, no. I was very private and secretive about my addiction.
Okay. And when you got to that point, you decided, I'm not going to wait for another holiday or another sort mm-hmm. of procrastination to do it. You did find what you needed relatively quickly, it sounds like?
Yes, yes. I knew where to go. And I just picked up the phone and called for help.
You talked about ending your ballet career.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a start of the challenge for you? Did it go back further? I mean, what do you think kind of set off the addiction as it manifested in your life?
I think that I always was predisposed for the addiction. You know, it would have gotten me eventually. But like I mentioned, I think that the ballet career kept me high functioning. You know, I can't go to ballet rehearsals under the influence of any substance. So it kept me on the, for the most part, straight and narrow. And then once I took that away, I had nothing keeping me in check, holding me responsible.
So it was less about losing an identity of work and more just about that you knew you couldn't.
Mm-hmm, the structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the focus and the structure, which is why transitioning into recovery fitness was so easy for me to, you know, to find that physical outlet and goal-oriented environment mm-hmm. that
You're a structure at. Person.
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. When did you start this recovery journey? When did you make that? How long ago was that?
Actually, about a year ago, I started my recovery journey. It was a long time coming.
Okay. And when you set out to do that,
mm-hmm.
are you telling any family or friends, like, just so you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
My family and my boyfriend, not so much, you know, my friends, just keeping it fairly private.
Okay. And how did you find the reaction among the people who did know?
Very supportive. Very, very supportive. Yeah.
did it scare you?
A little bit, yeah. You know, there's such a stigma with addiction, and I like that I can help, you know, put a face to it in a positive way, but it is very, makes you very vulnerable.
What, in terms of the physical part of it, either scared you the most, or were you thinking about going in? Because there's a lot of discussion about what it means to have addiction, possible withdrawal, physical symptoms. What did you think about going in?
Like the what physical changes did mm-hmm. I have in recovery?
Or perhaps what worried you, and then how did it actually play out?
I didn't have any worries. From the moment I decided, I was very diligent, and I knew this is what I wanted to do and what I needed to do. So, and I knew that it was only going to help me. So I didn't have any fears. Mm-hmm. I kind of just dove right in. I was a little afraid of the social stigma of coming out and saying, you know, I have an addiction. But through time, that has softened.
Boy, I hope so. And we'll talk more about that later in the hour, because that is so important. And I think all of our guests will have something to say about that. But if I can ask how you're doing in terms of about a year out,
mm-hmm.
have you had any relapse?
I did. I did not stick with it 100% when I first got in, and I did have a relapse, but I knew where to go once I came right back, and this time I've still been going strong.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is because I think it was Sean who first brought this up, you know, roughly a year ago, and I remember being at the 5K, he made some really mm-hmm. strong remarks, and also Were you at the 5K?
I was,
oh,
yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. So he made these really strong marks, and then we had a live connection. Well, it's all live. You're hearing us live here, unless you're hearing a recorded version or a podcast, in which case it's not live. That would be magic. In this case, though, we are live right now. What I mean is we are on the road with a live audience at the little theater, and you know, Sean is telling a story, or I might have actually here, but Sean was telling the story and just making me really reconsider even the word relapse, the idea that there's a lot of loaded pressure that a relapse is a failure or is an ending of recovery process, as opposed to really being part of a process, not saying everyone will or should or whatever, but taking away this idea that if it happens, that is the end or that's a failure. And I hope I'm faithfully mm-hmm. representing his remarks. Can you add to that, Yana?
Yeah, absolutely. I think relapse has this negative connotation, you know, that you lose everything you gained, whether it's skills, whether it's relationships, any progress you've made in your life. But really, you know, it's a chronic health condition. So if somebody's diabetic and they go into diabetic shock because they had, you know, food they're not supposed to, they don't lose all their knowledge of diabetes, all their knowledge about the treatment for diabetes. I think it can be part of recovery. It doesn't have to. Like you said, you're absolutely right. Sean has actually just completed an inpatient program. He's now in Canandaigua. He went through the VA, and it's been a long, long journey for him, and it's been a struggle. But I think the most important piece is to never give up, to never, ever give up, and relapse is not failure.
I don't know if Sean's listening. Is he listening?
I hope so.
We love you, brother. And I think that's such an important, powerful message. And that has stayed with me. Sarah, as a therapist, can you add to that, too, the importance of understanding relapse?
Yes, there was something I wanted to add to that. Something I talk a lot with my folks about is something you might hear a lot is people saying relapse is a part of recovery. And I don't agree with that. I always say relapse is a part of addiction. Because I think that distinction's important, because the addictive brain, that part of the brain, the addictive thinking, will hear that statement, relapse is a part of recovery, and it will say to them, aha, well, that means I get to relapse,
so
and I haven't
okay.
relapsed
yeah.
yet. Yeah, it gives it permission, because addictive thinking is all about irrational justifications of things. So I think that while it might sound like, you know, I'm being really picky with the wording, it actually, addictive thinking will latch on to things like that. So I don't think that in order to be successful in your sobriety or your recovery, you have to have had a relapse. I always also say, I think what someone does right after a relapse is very telling. That's what's most important to me.
So give me some examples of what you're looking for there.
So if someone comes to me and shares with me or calls me even in between, you know, our sessions or something and says, you know, either I really want to drink, I want to use, or I made a bad choice, I did use, I did drink. I think that is very telling. That's really huge, because they told on themselves. And telling on yourself is so important. The accountability piece, the telling on yourself, it's huge. So when someone has been sitting on that for a while, or I can tell, I mean, you know, at this point, I'm just pretty in tune with mm-hmm. what it looks like, but also pretty in tune with my clients tease me because I always call them my people, like they're my tribe, but pretty in tune with what they sound like, look like. So even if I can tell they're not doing well and they're not talking about it, that's telling to me about where they are in their process, because they're not talking about it. And they know, they already know they need to be talking about it and telling on themselves.
And Sarah, if someone says to you, well, I was doing well and then I relapsed, I mean, mm-hmm. I guess I failed. What are you telling them?
I tell them a lot of what these ladies were just saying is that, no, it doesn't erase all that you've done. It doesn't mean the last 6 months, the last 6 years even, you know, just disappeared. It's all about what are we going to do from here forward? Because mm-hmm. I think it's so important to be encouraging and help them dust themselves off, because they already feel ashamed and negative.
Well, I appreciate that. And Monica, now, just give me a little bit of a sense for what Rockcovery has meant to you.
Oh, wow. Rockcovery, for me personally, has been one of the main tools that I use in my maintaining my sobriety. I, of course, use other recovery groups throughout Rochester. But for me, it was the physical activity and the goal-oriented atmosphere that appealed to me. And a lot of people hear about it and, you know, they think, oh, well, I don't like exercising or physical fitness, so it's not for me. But one of the biggest things is the group support and the people that you meet there. And we all support each other in our recovery. And, you know, we make friends. And whether you're training for a 5K or, you know, just taking a boot camp class, it has had a very positive effect on me.
Awesome stuff. How many people now come into recovery regularly, Yana?
We still about 1,000 a year. We've connected, I was just looking at the numbers, over 3,500 people since we started.
Wow.
Pretty mind-blowing.
And where are you? How can people find you?
You could track us on our website. It's www.recoveryfitness.org. All of our events, the center schedule is on there. Also Facebook. We're a very lively group, so make sure to check us out.
Mm-hmm. Emily Balsh, can you tell us a little bit about your story that led you to recovery?
Sure. I'm one of those people that have relapsed quite a few times in the past. Yana was one of the first people I met when I came in to other resources for recovery. Was one of those people that just would walk right up to you, gave her a number. It was before they had the building, and they were just doing little events. But, you know, I went kayaking one time. She's someone that's been in my life for the past 5 years, and it's been really amazing to see recovery grow. She's someone I consider a true friend. And It's been a big help. It's nice to have other resources rather than just your typical suggestions of you need to do this or you have to do this to get, you know, it's about the connection and finding people that you're comfortable around.
When did you think you were really aware that you had an addiction?
Honestly, you know, I successfully completed drug court a few years ago. And if I look back now, I honestly don't even know if I was fully, like, honest with myself about how bad I was. Like, I actually have 20 months sober today, the longest I've ever been sober. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of courts. It's not to make family happy. And I've had a lot of realizations lately, you know. It's a mind game. It's crazy how my head works, at least. I can only speak for myself, but
I want to be careful when I ask about this one, but just because I hear a lot about the industry, you graduated SUNY New Paltz and started making your career as a chef?
Yeah, I wanted to go a different way, but I'm a convicted felon due to my addiction, so it's a little harder to find a path with a more professional career, but I've made a living cooking, yes.
I ask because there is at least conversation about the fact that there is a higher level of, and please, restaurant listeners all around Rochester, please, no, I'm trying. I know this is going to be a generalization. I know it's not everybody, and I know it's not everywhere. And feel free to call me out if you think we're off base, but you hear that there's a little bit more either hard drinking or drugs in kitchens.
Oh, absolutely.
You would say yes to that.
Yeah, and I was working somewhere where I kept trying to force it to work because it was a nice salary. You know, benefits, paid vacations. And I thought, you know, it was like that image of like, okay, I have something, I made it. And I kept trying to force it to work. And I kept relapsing, you know, and they'd take me back because I'm a good worker, but they'd be like, all right, go to detox, go to rehab, we'll hold your job for you. And that's not, I had to learn to care about myself and I made some changes and I don't work in like your typical restaurant now. It's more of a low-key thing, but for me, doing the next right thing for myself and learning to respect myself, I still make good money, I still get to cook, and it's the acceptance piece for me. Like, I had to accept that like certain atmospheres aren't healthy for me, and that's okay. Like, I was ashamed of it at first, like I should be able to go anywhere, do anything, but from learning who I am and knowing where I'm at on a specific day, like, I don't need to go certain places if it's not healthy for me, you know, and I'm okay with that.
Sure. And if that premise is true, why do you think there is a little bit more substance abuse in kitchens?
It's crazy hours. A lot of restaurants have bars in them, so, mm-hmm. you know, I started off as a heavy drinker, and then I ended up using heroin to quit drinking. That's, like, my delusional thinking, you know, because I can't drink when I'm using heroin. which helped me to hit my bottom a lot faster, at least, because alcohol is so accepted. But it's that party lifestyle, and I had that ego, and I had that mentality of, like, work hard, play harder, you know? And for someone with, like, the disease that I have, I can't be in that environment.
No, I hear you. But you truly were thinking, I've got to stop drinking, heroin will be that path?
Well, my drinking led me to end up in a very shady situation. And actually, while I was in college, I ended up in the Bronx, New York, with some strangers in my car shooting up heroin. And they gave me a bag for the ride down there from New Paltz that I had met in the bar while I was skipping class. And, you know, I had gotten home that night and I was like, this is heroin, you know, you hear about it, I'm not going to do it. And 30 seconds later, I turned around and did it, and I fell in love. And it's been a problem ever since. And that was 2005.
Okay, and so when you say it's been a problem ever since, how quickly did you feel like, I mean, did you ever sort of, in those earlier days of doing it, think, I am addicted, or did you think, I can stop it, I like it, I'm going to go after it, I'm going to keep doing it? Like, what was the mindset?
Until I actually learned about alcoholism and addiction, mm-hmm. it was like my justification for why I partied so hard. Like, oh, I'm an alcoholic, it's okay, you know, but it's like, I'm an alcoholic and I need to do things to like take care of myself so I don't go down that path. You know, there was a period where I kept waking up really sick and I wasn't making the connection that it was the drugs that was making me feel so bad in the morning, even though when I'd go and get them, I'd felt immediately better. But I was just so delusional. I didn't realize that, like, that was what was causing me to feel so bad.
So you're constantly chasing it, you know?
All the time.
All the time. Even when you wake up, it's almost like your body needs it right away or you're going to be sick.
By the end of this last time, I would be literally doing it and worrying about how I'm going to get more.
Dope sick all the time. Yeah. But when you say it wasn't, you know, certain things that pushed you to want to stop this, what was the driver, or what was there a day or a moment or an event that you said, like, enough?
Yeah. You know, in the past, like, with drug court and, like, trying to make my family happy or people telling me I had a problem, it was always, like, this material image, like, I need to have a place. I need to have a decent job. And I was just broken, like so broken. Like I didn't want to live if I was high. I didn't want to live if I was sober. Like I didn't know what to do. And I had actually left detox Christmas Eve for like the second time while I had been back out. And, you know, when my mom was still here, she was talking to me every day. And I was, as always, trying to do things to make other people happy. But there was one night, and I'm not like a religious person or, you know, I got on my knees and I was just like, I give up and I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what to do. Like, just somebody help me. And I don't even know who I was talking to. But the next morning, I was able to text someone that I had been in contact with who works for SBH that I was telling I was fine, even though I just left there, and said I needed help. Like, I'm still using, and one of the last things she did before she left her job there was get me right back in, and that was January 4th of 2018, and I haven't looked back since.
Wow. How are you doing now?
I have a life I never even knew I wanted, and I have peace, and I have happiness. I'm able to give love to people. I'm able to receive love. I have connection from things like recovery and other, you know, resources. Like, I have such a gratitude for life that I never had my entire life.
Wow. What do you want in your own future now?
You know, giving back makes me really happy. You know, I'm currently working on a resume. I want to get into Hillside and work with troubled kids because, you know, inside addiction, outside addiction, like, yeah, there's a stigma, and I feel like it's important for people to know that there is a solution and there is hope, but everybody struggles with life. Like, life's going to happen, you know? Like, and one thing I've learned from, you know, recovery and other things is just to be kind to everybody. you know, helping people makes me happy. It does a good thing for me, and it helps me stay connected and, like, have gratitude on a daily basis.
How are you doing physically in terms of the way, the difference between feeling, waking up feeling sick, needing to chase it, versus getting to a point now where I hope you wake up and you feel good?
I do. I ran the 5K last year. I don't run, but I ran it, and it felt great, you know? And, you know, I have friends, and Jan will invite me to workouts, and, like, I just say yes. You know, I say yes to life, and then I get there, and they're like, oh, we're doing, like, 200 pull-ups and 800 sit-ups, and I'm like, great, you know? But I do it, and you feel so good afterwards. It's just little accomplishments, like being present and enjoying life with people who can enjoy life.
Your community is, like, sort of jacked. I just want you to know that. The recovery community in Rochester is so jacked, but pretty much because of you and Sean. I just want to tell you. It's so awesome to see.
We have a really great group.
No, it's really great. Emily, I do want to ask you, you know, sort of seriously, you know, you refer to yourself as a convicted felon, you know, you have things in your life, as you say, that you didn't even know you wanted.
Yeah.
Are you confident that you're going to be able to work in a society that can be really judgmental about a record, about what someone's been through? How is that going?
You know, so far I've handled it well, and for me it's a tool, you know. All bad things have good that can come out of them, no matter what it is. It's just what kind of perspective you have. And, you know, it makes me relatable. You know, unfortunately, with this disease, a lot of people do have legal problems. But, you know, if anything, I just want to give hope to other people that think there's no hope. Because, you know, I've held a job for 18 months sober now. I haven't paid rent late once. You know, I've been able to make financial amends. Like, life's good.
That's awesome. Are you worried about being judged? Or that putting barriers up in your life?
You know, I worry more about judging others because that's something I do. And I know that other people, you know, it's part of human nature, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I think we all do that.
It's also part of, like, knowing who's healthy for me and who's not. Like, I have to discern things sometimes. But I'm at a point where I love myself from, like, being able to use all these other connections and being connected with people that, like, I'm someone that used to worry about what everyone thought of me and was, like, living in fear and trying to live for other people. And now that I live for myself, like, I can go anywhere, you know. I can hang out with anyone. I'll go golfing. I probably don't look like I belong on a golf course, but, like, you know, I don't care. I connect with people. I can be honest now. I can be open. I can be vulnerable. And, you know, I like breaking down those, you know, stereotypes and stigmas.
Congratulations to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
It's awesome. Really amazing stuff. Listening to Emily Balsh and Mo tell their stories. And we're late for our only break. So when we come back from the break, I want to hear from Sarah Ormsby about how her career, more than a decade of therapy and social work and helping people in similar situations, helping families, how that has evolved and how she sees the crisis in our community. And I think people like Emily in particular will be able to help us see, as we look at what to do about this kind of a crisis, maybe some of her perspective of what might be effective and what not. I mean, some of it comes from within, someone who's ready to find change, but boy, we're all hoping to continue to make progress on this. So we're talking about the recovery community with some members of Rockcovery Fitness, Living in Recovery. You just heard Emily Balsh and Monica Starr. Yana Kashper is the co-founder of Rockcovery Fitness, and Sarah Ormsby is a therapist and a social worker here in Rochester. Let's take that only break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a couple of longtime television journalists in our area sit down with us to talk about their decision to leave where they have been working. Helen B. and Duty Hofer left WXXI earlier this summer, and Norma Holland just left 13 Wham TV after 23 years there. We'll talk about appointment viewing, the future of journalism, the power of broadcast, and more with them next hour. Deborah writes on Twitter, much respect to your panelists and many thanks for sharing these stories. This will help people in the community. No doubt about it. That's why we're here, and that's why we always appreciate talking to to the team from Rockcovery, because it's a large and frankly it's been a growing community locally based on need, and there's some profound stories of hope happening during some tough and dark times. Now, speaking of hope, Sunday, September 15th at Mendon Ponds Park. It's the 2019 5K and the X Challenge for Rockcovery Fitness. You can walk, you can run. There's a 5K pave course. There's a 5K trail course. There's the X Challenge. And you can check out all of the information to sign up, register, rockcoveryfitness.org. They had about 500 plus people last year. They would love to see you at Mendon Ponds Park Sunday, September 15th, coming up here. It supports the kind of stories you're hearing this hour, and it's also just an awesome, awesome event. So you'll see a lot of community leaders there. They're there. They know the importance. It's going to be a great event. So Sarah Ormsby, you've been in your line of work for more than a decade now. Mm-hmm. What have you seen change in this community?
I think the biggest change is back when I was still working at an outpatient site through Unity, formerly Unity, it's now Rochester Regional, you know, pills, that was the epidemic. Mm-hmm. And all of the, I was working with 18 to 25 year olds, and it was just pills, pills, pills. And then probably just by luck of the draw during my years there, I never lost anybody. And it was always my biggest fear. And then I went off by myself, or on my own in my private practice in 2014. And several of the families and several of the patients I'd had there kind of followed me, or over time found me there. And so over time, I watched the progression into heroin, because, you know, pharmaceutical companies started making pills, you know, you couldn't crush them and just made them, you know, they were becoming harder to get. So I watched that progression into the heroin epidemic. And then also a change I personally started experiencing was losing people. So that was, you know, the biggest change. I think, you know, I haven't really seen a lot of change as it relates to, you know, alcoholism or, you know, other substances,
sure.
But mainly, yeah, with the opioids. Yeah, going from pills to heroin.
What do you do to help families in particular? Because, I mean, some of the really, really hard stories have been, for me, talking to parents who didn't know what to do and felt like, how do I help without enabling? How do I decide where tough love's appropriate? How do I put ultimatums? How do I do any of the things that are actually going to help? It's really hard for families.
Mm-hmm. It's very hard. I always, you know, tell all parents to be really kind to themselves, because they're very hard on themselves. And I always point out that you don't, because all the parents I have, some of them I've worked with for almost 10 years, you know, off and on, and they'll say, they'll kind of criticize themselves the way they were back, you know, 8 years ago, 7 years ago. And I say, but you didn't know what you didn't know. And sadly, with this experience, you can only learn as you go, unfortunately. And so, you know, I just try to encourage them to be really compassionate with themselves and not so critical of themselves. And I just teach them about what, you know, how to define enabling, and so that they know what to look for, you know, is by doing, you know, A, B, and C for my son or daughter, am I allowing them to be irresponsible? Am I trying to shield them from natural consequences? If the answer is yes to that, then that's how you know you're enabling. And just helping them to practice better self-care, because parents never do. I also, I think it was like maybe 2 years ago now, 2 or 3 years ago, formed a small group of siblings. It was a therapy group for siblings, because I feel like siblings of addicts and alcoholics are the silent sufferers. They're kind of lost in the shuffle. There's a lot of support out there for parents, for children of addicts and alcoholics, but and even for spouses, but not for siblings. And so I had this group of, it happened to be all sisters at the time, and just really helped give them a voice. And the relatability with the other sisters they met was so helpful to them. They talked about that all the time, because they feel so alone, because all the focus has been on their sibling for so long. You know, their parents are just hyper focused on, quote unquote, saving their son or daughter who's sick. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, when it comes to the challenge of an opioid and a heroin epidemic, can I ask you, Emily, just what you would maybe tell the people in various sort of halls of power here, whether it's government policy, the medical community, et cetera, everyone wants to help. Do you think, generally speaking, there's much more to be done that isn't being done? You know, what might help change the current epidemic?
I mean, I know there's a lot of resources out there, and I guess this is part of why I don't have a problem talking about myself or sharing my story, because a lot of it, I know for me, it was in my head of people always judging me, I'm never going to be good enough, those feelings of just like, I'm a horrible person, I'm a heroin addict, and it's just a matter of like love and tolerance, giving some kindness to people, you know, you don't have to be in the field to be a part of the solution, like just be kind to people. Mm-hmm. It's a sickness, you know? I had trouble wrapping my head around the fact that this is a disease because I felt like it was just an excuse and I should be strong enough to do this on my own. But it's been that connection with people and, you know, acceptance of who I am that's really helped me get to a solution and not want to go back. You know, I see it all the time. I can recognize someone from a mile away because I was that person for so long. And it's just a matter of kindness, a smile, you know.
That's really good. No, it's really good. And I also want to ask you, Emily, when you hear, you know, Sarah talk about from her perspective in the field that the term enabling is probably best defined as if you're doing something that would shield someone from natural consequences, you're probably enabling. But for you, was it important eventually to end up with consequences that pushed you to change? I mean, how do you feel about the term enabling?
I was very enabled by my mom while she was alive. You know, it was really hard for her to learn to not do that, you know, like, you can love someone, but you can love them from a distance. Doesn't mean you love them any less. You actually love them more to be able to push them in the right direction. Like, I personally needed that. It's a boundaries thing, I guess. It's tough, you know? Like, when you start feeling and you love someone, you want to help them, and it's natural instinct to want to, like, nurture them. But, you know, for me, jail, overdosing, losing jobs, being eviction, like, I just, that was normal to me. Like, I, it wasn't consequences after a while, you know? When I was on drug court, I was like, I originally had a prison sentence hanging over my head, and then he gave me county time, and then I got another charge and was given more county time, and I was sitting there like, well, maybe give me my prison time back because I can smoke there. Like, no rational human being should be thinking like that who cares about themselves. Like, it was my normal, you know? And for me, the consequences I had to suffer were, like, finally accepting that, like, I'm scared of feelings. I just wanted to block those out my whole life. And, you know, that I was mentally, emotionally broken, you know? It wasn't the material things or those consequences, because material things are so easy to get back. I can't get my life back if I go back out and die, because that's 99% probably what will happen with all the fentanyl on the streets now. So,
yeah. Mo, how do you feel about the idea of enabling and the importance of consequences?
I definitely think that consequences led me to where I am. What am I trying to say here? People sometimes ask you if you regret having an addiction, and if I didn't have this addiction, I wouldn't know what I know now about people in recovery. You know, when I first went into recovery myself, I had the stigma that people in recovery are bad people, and you know that. And now they're some of my best friends.
Did you mean like you think like, well, I'm not going to be in that group. Like, you know, those people have problems.
Yeah. You know, you're sitting in the waiting room ready to go into treatment and you're looking at, you know, you're judging. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I said, through recovery, all of my best friends are people in recovery and we support each other. So if I had never had my addiction, I would probably still have that stigma and that judgment. And I know this isn't talking a lot about enabling because I didn't really identify with that too much. There wasn't a lot of enabling in my story and my journey. But speaking towards the, what I've learned through my consequences. It's obviously been hard, but there have been a lot of positive experiences to come from it. And now, just wanting to get involved in helping people myself that maybe I would not have known about before.
So when you talk about stigma and you say that the past version of you might have been one of those people judging,
mm-hmm.
what's the message for anyone listening who might not even realize about themselves? Because I think people like to think of themselves as, well, I'm a good person, I'm kind, but I'm sure I do it too. What's the message for anyone who might not even realize about themselves? You are judging and you're making it harder for people.
Mm-hmm. You obviously don't know everybody's story. You can't know. So when you see someone, they could be suffering. They could just need help. You know, like you said, they could just need some kindness, you know, just to help them make the next right decision in their lives. And you might even see something in yourself that you haven't been wanting to look at, that you're suffering yourself.
Sarah, what would you say about stigma and what you want people to hear?
I've had people say incredibly insensitive things to me about why would you even bother working with those people and with addicts and, you know, just ignorant things. Even back at Unity, I remember having to battle with insurance companies, even then had rude representatives who would just be rude and insensitive. And so something I have found helps me respond to people who do have that kind of ugly stigma is I just say to them, here's the thing, based on the way you're speaking, I can tell that you've never loved anybody who's struggled with addiction. And I hope for your sake, you never have to. But I also hope that, you know, God forbid if you do, that someone will show you a lot more kindness and sensitivity than you're showing right now.
Mm. Jana, do you see in our community a change? There's no way to measure this, right? But whenever there is a change in pattern in terms of what substances are being abused, how it manifests and the people who struggle with them, there's probably an adjustment period. And here we are now. This is the epidemic, especially with opioids, but addiction is not new. Are we doing better as a community and not stigmatizing?
I think we're definitely doing better. If you look back 5, 6, 7 years ago especially, you didn't hear too many stories of recovery. You definitely didn't hear a whole lot of folks in power even talk about recovery, let alone your everyday person. Families really suffered in silence. You know, now unfortunately, we have all these obituaries that talk about their loved one's addiction spread that message, you know, that they're not ashamed, that there is no shame. There's no shame in having addiction, and there's definitely no shame in getting help.
Expanding programs and staff for you means a lot of work, but it's important work. Tell us about what's going on with Recovery.
Yeah, we started a chapter in the Southern Tier. We have events multiple times a week, from functional fitness classes to yoga and hikes. It's an area that really doesn't have a whole lot. You know, there's not really public transportation. There's not a lot of opportunities for mutual aid groups. And we've been able to tap into a network, and we've been so well received. You know, and we're hoping, and we are growing instrumentally in embedding individuals in recovery with lived experience, outreach specialists, into non-traditional settings like primary care, the justice system, to really be able to help folks through the entire process in their addiction recovery.
This is a true story I'm about to tell you, and I have not told Jana this yet. But I was wearing my Warrior Challenge shirt from the 5K last year. By the way, I just did the regular 5K. It's just but I'm wearing my shirt because it's actually like one of the most comfortable shirts I own, and I'm proud to wear it. And I wear it everywhere. And I'm on the way down to Southern Tier going camping in a yurt and stop at a diner in Arkport. Okay. And someone stops me and is like, Recovery Fitness is amazing. Mm-hmm. And was telling me a story about how it is helping someone that they know. Down in Arkport,
wow.
Notice my shirt.
Wow.
Yeah. How do you like that?
That's incredible. That blows my mind.
That's really, it's a wide reach now. So, again, if you want to get in touch What do you want people to know about getting in touch and what's available through Recovery?
Definitely reach out to us. We are on 1035 Dewey Avenue in the heart of the city on a bus line. We have something for everyone. We actually do have a sibling support group that started. It's once a month. We just have so much. It's not just a fitness group. We're not just a gym. We really have something for everyone, and we'd love to have everyone check us out.
All right, coming up on Sunday, September 15th, Mendon Ponds Park. It's the event, the annual 5K and X Challenge that Recovery Fitness puts on, and it's a great event. You can walk it, you can run it. There's a regular 5K course, there's a trail course, and there's an X Challenge course as well. And you can jump on rockcoveryfitness.org if you want to register, get information. Sign up in advance. They'd love to know you're coming, and they had more than 500 people, so it was packed. So it's a great community out there, and it's for everyone supporting this community, Sunday, September 15th. You know, in a sense, I was going to congratulate you on your growth. I mean, I don't think that this is one of those organizations that we wish you didn't have to grow. But I want to thank you for what you're doing and just say congratulations on the success of the people who've come through your doors, because we've met so many of them. Thank you very much, Jenna.
Thank you, Evan.
And the two people sharing their stories today, Mo and Emily, just continued success and love and kindness, really powerful messages. Mo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
And Sarah Ormsby, thanks for the work you do in our community as a licensed therapist and social worker. Thank you for sharing your perspective this hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, more connections coming up.